morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. Congress is looking at federal support for school lunches in ways that have some nutritionists up in arms. We'll get the Hawaii perspective on proposed changes to the law. And organic farming is more than a business. It's a philosophy and a way of life. We'll talk with Una Greenaway, president of the Hawaii Organic Farming Association.
And I'm Kathy Kozak. Don't be fooled by the seemingly simple melody. Pianist and professor Thomas Rosenkrantz will share why Bach's Goldberg variations are considered a musical Rubik's Cube. And celebrating the culture of the healthiest, longest living people in the world, the Okinawans, we'll talk with Ambassador Shari Tamashiro.
It's Thursday, May 26th. Those conversations and a few more after the news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. I think I want some lunch now.
I guess. Well, that's good because we are talking about food here as we enjoy our turnover for breakfast this morning. The U.S. Congress is engaged in a debate over school lunches with proposals in the air that critics say could limit the number of free and reduced price meals provided to low-income children. Meanwhile, schools are operating under federal guidelines that limit the amount of sodium, fats, and sugar that goes into their meals. Dexter Kushida is a supervisor with the Hawaii Department of Education School Food Services Branch, who's been involved with school nutrition for almost two decades as a cafeteria manager, school food coordinator, and we asked him for the local perspective. Good morning, Dexter. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
First of all, the discussion on the federal front has not yet had a result, right? It's a discussion that's in the air. Can we sort of sum up what's being discussed?
Sure. The House and the Senate and Congress both have two very different bills that went to the floor. The House version is the one that we're discussing now and has some very has the potential of having some very big effects to the school nutrition program nationwide. One of them that you mentioned is the funding mechanism.
Yeah.
There's a proposal in the House version to have a pilot project to do a block grant. Currently, the funding mechanism is a reimbursement. So the more students we serve, the more reimbursement the more reimbursement the state would receive. A block grant would be a finite sum of money that the state would receive up front. And if participation increases this year, then the district would need to come up with the
You have to make funding. Do with a fixed amount no matter how many kids you've got to
correct,
feed.
Correct, correct.
Which I think would be pretty daunting for somebody in your position.
It does because it almost would disincentivize us of wanting to feed children because with finite money and wanting to be a good steward of public funds,
sure.
What would we do?
Well, in your position in Hawaii, there really is no other state where you have the kind of job that you have, right? You've got 100,000 kids a day to feed.
We do. We have 100,000 meals that we prepare every day, and it's across the state. We're the only state that's one school district and one school food authority.
Right.
So it definitely is a challenging and unique task separated from the continent by a few thousand miles of water.
What are the advantages of that?
Well, as one school system, we have the same product or the same level of service from Hilo to Hanalei.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can ensure as one state entity, as one school food authority, that we're providing the very best to everyone in the state.
What are the disadvantages, Dexter?
Logistics. Logistics is definitely a challenge. While maybe Oahu Port doesn't have an issue receiving large ships, when we get to some of our smaller islands, Lanai, Molokai, or even getting it to Hana, Maui, we definitely get as creative as we can to get the products to the schools.
You've got to get to reach the outlying counties and areas. You've got to go to barges, even planes. Yeah.
If need be, we'll run a big truck halfway up to Hana, and a small truck will come down, meet it, we switch it over, and take it up the rest of the way.
Yeah. Well, the uniformity is obviously an advantage, and as uniformity of what's being delivered becomes that more important, as we understand more and more about nutritional guidelines, right? That's where a lot of this discussion has been going.
Definitely, definitely. Hawaii has started ahead of the USDA in getting ready for these changes. As we looked down the road, we definitely knew the rules on school nutrition were going to change. They need to. We're living in a world that, or when school nutrition was first started, the school meals were provided because we were an undernourished society. The military were receiving folks that couldn't pass the physicals.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're living in the polar opposites, where we're battling both hunger and overnutrition or obesity as an epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another different place we're in, and we need to move to ensuring that the hunger get fed, but not just calories now, but very highly nutritious meals.
Yeah.
So incorporating more whole grains and different types of colors of vegetables, so there's a wide range of nutrients that'll be going and kid consuming.
Ironically, Dexter, the obesity epidemic, and it's been called that in America, right, isn't a product of people getting an overabundance of excellent quality food. It's rather the opposite. It's the kind of food that they're eating that leads to obesity. Am I right?
Correct. The highly refined grains, high calorie but very low nutrition items that were allowable. When I first started in school food, we'd put Jell-O on every plate because the rules were we needed X amount of calories,
mm-hmm.
and it no fat, high calorie.
Cheap source of lots of calories.
Correct, correct.
And it was calories being measured, not nutritive value in any way.
Correct, correct.
Which is kind of amazing when you look at it from today's perspective.
2020 hindsight, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah, Jell-O on a plate, mac and cheese, cream chip beef, those are the staples.
Stuff,
right?
I grew up with.
Lots of bread, so high sugar, high fat, mm-hmm. high everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an easy it's certainly not an overnight transition to make, is it?
It's not. Just even looking at whole grains, it was over 4 years that the department slowly increased the amount of brown rice mm-hmm. to get to now we're at 100% brown rice. If we did it overnight, we may have some revolts in the cafeteria.
Well, yeah, because one of the things is that we have a society that's been trained to enjoy pretty unhealthy food.
Yes.
Because, you know, our taste buds have been attuned to it. And there's been some pushback to the whole nutritious food movement in schools, hasn't there?
Definitely, definitely. We serve 2 out of 3 meals in a school, so a breakfast and a lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So students still do eat outside of what we're feeding, and fast food, or even at home. We may not have made that transition to healthier alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Our staff has done a pretty good job, though, in going through the process of change. So taking small baby steps to get to whole grain, slowly incorporating more and more dark leafy greens. So kids are used to it and not just iceberg lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
So it's baby steps, and sometimes we get a little anxious because it doesn't feel like we're moving fast enough. But looking back, it's all about process mm-hmm. to get there.
Well, the palate has to be trained. I mean, nobody likes to take on food that tastes completely different from the food they grew up on, whether that food is healthy or not, right?
Correct, correct. I loved, we had a turkey corn scallop growing up in public school here. It went away for a little bit because it's cream, butter, those kinds of products. It was an excellent,
sounds
excellent.
Great.
It, doesn't it? Doesn't it come over? And those are the items that we're reformulating to find better ways to do it, that mm-hmm. we can get flavor profile close, palate feel close, and still offer it to our kids.
You really have to get down to that detail, as you say, flavor profile, palate feel. Those are kind of the technical terms of your world, but that's also how people's minds work and what, you know, it doesn't do any good if it doesn't get eaten, right?
Exactly. It's not nutrition if it's not eaten.
Yeah. You are going to be providing meals over the summer, is that right?
We are. The department has a few initiatives that we do to ensure better access for our students because, again, it's not nutrition unless it's eaten.
Yeah.
And during the summer months, it should be out soon, a list on HawaiiPublicSchools.org of the 67 sites that will be providing summer meals. We realized that we may provide 180 days of school meals, but then there's 6 weeks out of summer that what do these students that yeah. normally rely on a wholesome hot meal,
yeah.
What would they do? So we provide that at 67 sites, and it's available to any student under 18. Show up. Ideally, you would call the school you're going to just so they make sure that they can have the meal available.
Sure.
But show up, and it's free of charge. You don't need to fill out any application or lengthy interview process.
What's not to like?
Exactly.
Thanks so much for coming in, Dexter. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Dexter Kushida is a supervisor with the Hawaii Department of Education School Food Services Branch, who's been involved with school nutrition for almost two decades. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, a classical masterpiece that still inspires to this day. But here's your quiz first. O Mau, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
Later in the program, we'll be hearing about the business side of organic farming. Continuing with that theme, for today's backyard quiz, we're going to be looking at agriculture. The island of Molokai is unique in many ways. One of these is the fact that the agriculture industry is a major driver of that island's economy. Whereas tourism and defense have dwarfed other industries throughout Hawaii, farming is still a vital source of both economic and physical sustenance for Molokai residents. But this would not be possible without a certain key ingredient, water. This poses a problem on Molokai, where much of the arable land is located on the dry, leeward side of the island. To address this problem, a complex series of aqueducts was built to transport water from rainy and mountainous northern Molokai to farms in the central and leeward parts of the island. For today's question, what is the name of this system that delivers water to the Molokai farms? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the HPR t-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Gail Harimoto from Pro City. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Born in 1685, Johann Sebastian Bach is considered one of the greatest composers of all time. His composition, Goldberg Variations, is just one of the pieces that pianist Thomas Rosenkrantz has played as he tours around the world to four different continents thus far. He's a former faculty member of the University of Hawaii at Manoa and currently serves as an associate professor of piano and musical arts at Bowling Green State University. He's currently on sabbatical, which ends in August. He'll be sharing his talent playing the Goldberg Variations in concert this weekend. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Goldberg Variations. It's an hour or so long piece. What was the inspiration for Bach? Was there some guy named Goldberg?
Actually, there was. The story goes, there was a Count Kaisenberg who loved Bach's music, and he commissioned Bach to write a harpsichord piece. And so the Count had a staff harpsichordist by the last name Goldberg, who was about 14 at the time. And this young boy played the Goldberg variations of Bach, and the Count loved the piece. And the Count loved it so much that he gave Bach a gold coin. There's a story that's not true, that it was perhaps written so that the Count could go to sleep by it, you know, like to cure his insomnia. That actually is completely not true, but it makes for a good story.
Yeah. Well, it makes for a good story, but I have to say the music doesn't necessarily make you fall asleep.
It's not going
to
make you. Yeah, I hope not. You don't want to. If you play the piece, you don't want people to fall asleep. No.
No. Generally not really your goal. Now, the harpsichord is entirely different than the piano. Uh-huh. So to play this piece, you really have to be creative. There's a lot of hands that cross, a lot of different uh-huh. ways that you have to use your physical body to embody what would have been easier on a harpsichord. What's the difference?
Well, you said exactly right. I mean, it was originally written for a two-manual harpsichord. And so our modern piano only has one manual. And so what happens is a lot of times the hands have to share notes and they have to share things. So there's a choreography in the piece which you can't hear unless you obviously you have to see the piece live, you know. So there's a lot of almost like Tai Chi-like moments where I'm extended, and it's the only way to actually play the piece if you're extended in certain ways. A lot of hand crossing that Bach got from Scarlatti, things like that. So there's a real physicality to the piece, but that's another reason why I think the piece, you know, you have to see it live, you know.
Well, and people will have a chance to do so this weekend. This is one particular genre of music that you play, but you've also branched out into some other really unique aspects of musical culture.
Yeah, well, I think music is of course amazing and so interesting, but you know, classical music is just one kind of vehicle. And that's, you know, if you're a classical musician, you have access to all this great Western music. But also in other cultures, there's these amazing systems. In China, there's a different kind of system. And in Tunisia, there's a different kind of system. And the piano is really versatile. So if you're willing and interested, you can sort of travel to these other places in a musical way.
Now, there's a difference, you know, as a classically trained musician, you become an expert at all of these wonderful pieces written by the masters. And then you've spent some time abroad and found that music in other cultures is much more about getting together and having sort of like a jam session.
It's true. I mean, I think, you know, in the West, we're sometimes obsessed with certain exactitudes, or you know, everything has to be sort of perfect. But in other cultures, it's a more communal thing. It's a more it's an experience. You experience music with other people, and that's wonderful. Like for instance, in India, if you go to an Indian music concert, if someone likes what you're playing in the concert, they'll shout at you, or they'll yell at you, and like they'll root you on like a baseball game or something like that. And in some places,
like I couldn't picture that happening.
Yeah,
here.
I mean, imagine like you know you play
you're in the Atherton and someone's
a classical
like, yeah,
concert, and they like you know this fast lick that you did, and they'll actually start clapping. But in other cultures, that's totally normal. In the West, our culture is to, you know, if you're an audience member, you sit quietly and listen to the music. But in other cultures, it's much more raucous. You know,
it uses a totally different part of your brain, I think. Like if you're in these other countries, you know, you've spent some time in places like Tunisia, and if you're there, the experience of music is so different, you kind of have to use a different part of your brain to just be
right.
Impromptu and just go with the flow.
Yeah, and you have to be willing to just put away what you've learned in the conservatory, actually, and just try to understand the people you're playing with and try to understand where they're coming from and have a conversation. I mean, the name of this show is Conversation, but have a conversation with them. And a good conversation is never just you're talking at someone. You're actually dialoguing with someone else, and you're someone says something, and then you think that reminds you of, oh, yes, this blah, 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 blah. And music, really interesting music for me is like that.
So where are your musical experiences right now? You've mastered the classical repertoire. where do you see yourself going as a musician in the near future?
Well, I haven't mastered anything. I mean, I still consider myself a student, and you know, every day I must practice very hard. But that's a good thing to know.
If you want to be a master, you got to practice.
You never master something. But right now I'm living in China in Chengdu, and that's a really interesting place to live. And over there in Chengdu, in Sichuan province, and in China in general, the piano is really exploding thanks to people like Lang Lang. Piano concerts over there are filled with young people. Over here in the States, you know, and it, well, if you go to a classical concert, it's mostly people that are older. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. But in China, it's absolutely the opposite. And so for me, that's really interesting. Why is it that there's all these younger people that are fascinated with classical concerts and the piano? And so I wanted to be part of that for at least a year, you know.
Now that's ending in August.
It's so sad.
You have to get back to the real job now. Sabbatical is over.
I know. I'm sad about that. But I'm preparing now for the transition.
Well, I bet it'll be a smooth one. You've been working hard. The definition of sabbatical for you has been teaching piano and working hard in China. So you've really been almost an ambassador of the piano to another area, and it inspired the youth to really get excited about doing different works in piano, and you're teaching the next generation.
Well, I hope so.
Now, when you play this weekend, you're going to be playing the Goldberg Variations. Is there one particular part that's your favorite?
Actually, I'm really fond of Variation 13. I'm really fond of the slower variations, but Variation 13 is like improvisation, actually, and it's something that, you know, whenever it comes up, it's always after this really fast variation, and it's the first really calm variation. I suppose you could say that. And each time I get to it, it always feels like a different piece. I always try to play it in a way that I haven't played it before. That's a favorite of mine. And then there's one also towards the end, Variation 25, which is for some reason nicknamed the Black Pearl variation, and it's in G minor, and harmonically weird and strange, and like Bach goes on a strange journey in that piece harmonically, and it wanders off and you don't know when it's going to come back, and it's really haunting and beautiful. So those, I would say, the slower ones are my favorite ones to play at the moment.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for telling us a little bit about yourself and also what you'll be playing. Look forward to Variations 13 and 25. Thomas Rosenkrantz was hailed as one of the best new musical performers around by American Record Guide. His first solo CD, Toward the Curve, debuted last May, and he will be showcasing his talent playing Goldberg Variations this Saturday at Atherton Studio. More information at hpr2.org.
Once a wartime prize, today it wins the prize for devastation and suffering.
More than anywhere else in Japan, probably, Okinawa has suffered from American weapons of mass destruction.
The U.S. presence on Okinawa has been more destructive than any war. Stored chemical weapons sink into the ground along with accountability. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Four-wheel drives, helicopters, steel towers, and satellite dishes. It takes more than a silky voice to make radio. Member donors are the real backup generators for public radio stations, and Hawaii Public Radio sends our mahalo to Ann Anjin of Honolulu, Jonathan Pelikau of Waipahu, and Dawn Suter of Kailua. If listening to HPR helps you face the world, help us with the hard costs of radio. A membership form is available at hawaiipublicradio.org. Or you can talk to a real person at 955-8821 during business hours.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Learn more about contributing personal stories at CompassionandChoicesHawaii.org.
In recent years, Kauai has become a flashpoint for the struggle between environmentalists and agribusiness, one that has generated more heat than light with more than its share of rumor and exaggeration. Established facts have been in short supply. Now a newly completed fact-finding report commissioned by the state and Kauai County calls for stricter controls on pesticide use by seed companies, even as it admits that, in Governor Ige's words, there's a lot we don't know. Chad Blair has more in this morning's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
This is the kind of study that's unlikely to completely satisfy either side, yeah?
Right. One of the authors of the report acknowledges, look, there's always going to be absolutists on either end of the spectrum, people mm-hmm. that are not going to accept any conclusions other than what they view as the truth about pesticide use from GMO companies and others. But here is what the study said. Bottom line, there is no serious threat to humans, animals, plants, and water sources. But as you indicated, there's still a lot that we do not know. The state needs to do a better job. There are gaps in the data monitoring and surveillance that is leading us, or rather is preventing us from reaching a definitive conclusion on the impact of pesticides sprayed on crops.
Now, the seed companies were represented on this fact-finding panel, but a couple of them quit, right?
Yeah, they sure did. Three members total, one from DuPont, one from Dow Agro, another from UH Tropical Ag. And according to the report, they resigned because they either disagreed with the composition of the panel. In other words, is it balanced seed company interest, environmental science, and so forth? Or because the results that came out from the report did not favor their own views. So certainly one might take that into account. Generally, environmental groups are responding positively to the report. They're praising it. Even the lobby that represents the seed company is saying, look, there's no serious threat. All this scare tactics that are going into saying you can't spray here, you can't spray there. So, you know, there's enough to go around to satisfy, as one person said, 80 to 90% of the people out there. But again, people will, on both ends, probably will never be completely satisfied.
Well, Chad, just going back to those resignations for a second, it's a fact-finding panel, right? So
you
know what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, yes, I do. And they did a lot of research. They looked at a lot of data. They had listening tours. They really spent time. I should say the report says, look, this is not going to impinge on the ability of seed companies to do their job. Remember, California, the largest state, with the largest agricultural economy, is using these very same protocols and procedures when it comes to GMO, pesticides, and so forth. So that should come as some hope to seed companies that want to continue doing business here. I can tell you, Governor David Ige likes the report. He said he's open to all recommendations. His ag chair, Scott Enright, said so as well. What they're going to do is they're going to start prioritizing a short-term response. Ige said he was particularly attracted to this aspect that the report called for a rapid response deployment team should somehow an incident involving pesticides occur, that the state and counties would be able to quickly respond.
So everybody gets to continue doing business, but it's likely that stricter monitoring is in the near future.
No question. And remember, when this draft report came out in March, something that was reiterated in the final report, it is recommended that GMO seed companies disclose, you know, what restricted use pesticides they are using, where they're using, and how much. And of course, that's always been something the seed companies have been a bit reluctant to do. But that is a recommendation that is being put forth.
Well, I doubt if that will end the debate entirely.
Me neither.
It's progress of a sort. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. Yeah,
Good morning. It's 8:33. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. I'm Kathy Kozak, and you can reach us at Hawaii Public Radio in several different ways. Our talkback line, 808-792-8217. We're also on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, organic farming is a profitable business, and later, celebrating the culture of the longest living people in the world. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
You probably have it on your phone, maybe in your car, but how much do you think about the technology of GPS? And do you rely on it too much? You might, according to Greg Milner. We'll talk with the author of Pinpoint, How GPS is Changing Technology, Culture, and Our Minds, this afternoon at 5 on Town Square.
Good morning. I'm Lara Reynolds from the Oahu Invasive Species Committee. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
And you're back with The Conversation on HPR2. Organic farmers are working to return the land to where it used to be, when rich soils gave us abundant crops that yielded a sustainable harvest year after year. The business of organic farming in today's world depends on access to rich, chemical-free soil, but that's only one of the challenges farmers face. They'll be comparing notes and sharing secrets this Saturday at the annual conference of the Hawaii Organic Farming Association. And Una Greenaway, HOFA's president, is on the line with us now. Good morning, Una.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You've been doing this for a while, yeah?
Yeah, I've been farming organically here in Captain Cook for 39 years.
39 years ago, there wasn't that much of organic farming, was there?
No, it was. There were only a few places you could acquire fertilizer here in Kona, but
yeah.
There actually were. It was not easy, and there certainly was no cost. There certainly was no benefit financially to do it. You know, we grew organically because we were organic in our heart, because it was the pono thing to do.
Well, yeah, it's sort of a marriage of business and philosophy for you,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. Absolutely.
But in order to live that, what are the challenges you've had to face in those 39 years?
Well, my number one crop, cash crop, is coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to rebuild the soil. We acquired an old coffee farm, trees that are over 100 years old.
Yeah.
And we let ground cover come back in, we mow and weed eat the farm. We had to build up the mycorrhizae, the good life in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you don't have ground cover, you don't have life, and you don't have the same kind of life in the soil. And coffee trees really do like good, life. They need that to survive. So that's always been a challenge. The fertilizer costs are up there, and then we've always had, there have been quite a few labor costs in keeping our weeds down. So those have been our main challenges.
When you in the search for good soil, do you sometimes find, or do organic farmers sometimes find that they have to replenish soil that's been damaged by prior uses?
Yes. There are a lot of people do bioremediation of soil in order to be certified organic. If you come onto a farm that has had pesticides or herbicides sprayed, you must wait 3 years before you can become certified organic.
Oh, really?
According to the USDA rules, yes.
No quicker path to that. Well, that's a...
No, there's no quicker path than 3 years.
That's a sacrifice that you've got to be ready to make right off the bat, isn't it?
Absolutely. Those farms are called transitional organic farms.
But I certainly see the word organic you know, surface on just about everything in the grocery store now, and you can't help but wonder who decides that. It's different in different cases, isn't it?
No, if it says certified organic, then it is. Then it, that means it is certified by an agency that is also certified by the USDA, by the National Organic Program. That program came about around 2002, and basically the USDA owns that word. You can't use that word. You can't use certified organic unless you are certified. And if you are, you can use the word organic if you're not certified, only if you make less than $5,000 gross on your farm. And HOFA actually offers a small farm that's called the small farm exemption. And HOFA is now offering an affidavit. We sort of, you don't absolutely need it, but we verify. We kind of work with the farmer a little bit just to verify that that under $5,000 person is doing the right thing.
But so there is a, it sounds as if that's a pretty rigorous mechanism in place to make sure that organic is in fact
organic.
And
you know, it's there to protect the consumer. Certification protects the consumer. It doesn't really protect the farmer. It's a third-party verification, you know, that what the farmer is saying is true.
Well, I mean, how tough a life is it to be an organic farmer, you know?
We love being organic farmers. There are a lot of benefits. The food tastes better. There's no pesticide residue. We build our soil with compost and rock powders and composted fish waste. And guess what? Your children and your adults can walk all over your farm, and they're safe.
Yeah.
And that's there's a large peace of mind there that that's important. And, you know, people don't understand that, you know, farmers, farm workers all over the United States, you know, they are exposed to quite a few dangerous pesticides. And you know, when you're purchasing organic food, you're not supporting that.
Well, it's still, I get the impression, Una, that it's a life that is not for the faint of heart, right?
Well, you know, obviously with the right equipment, you know, you can make all your compost and you can turn your piles and you can mow your fields. And, you know, it's like any other business. It takes an investment.
Sure.
You know, and we are happy with that the Representative Chris Lee put forth this bill to help to help certified organic farmers get a bit more, to get a tax break, a Hawaii state tax break, to help cover some more of the certification costs and also costs like inspection costs and fertilizers and seeds and things that are very pricey. And sometimes we do have to get special things that aren't kept here, and then you have to pay a lot of shipping to get them here. And, you know, yeah. It's tough,
but
it's a rewarding. It's a very rewarding system. And you know, one of the big challenges in our country is that, you know, as you, it's been in the news many times about aging farmers, and you know, I think the average age is something like 60. And I'm 60, so I guess I'm the average age of the older farmer.
That's why we picked you.
We need to engage. You know, there's a huge movement to engage younger farmers, but quite honestly, most of them really do want to be involved with organics.
Well,
they're not really that excited about, you know, using pesticides.
Well,
so
opportunities are there.
I do think it is the direction that we are heading.
Sounds like a pretty good direction for all of us, Una. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and so we are having our conference at the Key Project in Kaneohe this Saturday. Please come. And our website is hawaiiorganic.org.
Sounds good.
Thank you
so much. Una Greenaway is a certified organic farmer from the Kealakekua area on Hawaii Island. She's been farming organically for 39 years, growing Kona coffee, mac nuts, cacao, bananas, citrus, avocados, and pineapples. She's the president of the Hawaii Organic Farming Association, or HOFA, which is having its annual conference this Saturday in Kaneohe. Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you for the name of a complex water delivery system on Molokai that makes farming there possible. Built in the late 1960s, this engineering marvel is the primary source of water for agriculture on Molokai. It collects surface and groundwater from the rainy mountains of northern Molokai and delivers it to the drier but flatter region in central Molokai that is better suited for farming. The system is entirely gravity-fed and incorporates a 5-mile tunnel, concrete flumes, and over 4 miles of pipe. Collected water eventually settles into a 1.4 billion gallon reservoir. From there, it is distributed to 230 customers using an additional 22 miles of piping. By law, 2/3 of this water is reserved for use by native Hawaiians on Hawaiian homestead lands, but farms of all types and sizes are currently served by the Molokai Irrigation System, or MIS. And that's today's answer. It's 8:48, and that's today's quiz. If you have one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Okinawa Prefecture is the southernmost prefecture of Japan, comprised of hundreds of the Ryukyu Islands, with a tropical climate and the largest number of people living over 100 years of age and getting there in great physical condition as well. In addition to celebrating this, the annual Okinawan Festival also celebrates their unique culture as well, tracing centuries-old patterns of migration all over the world. Shari Tamashiro is a third-generation Okinawan American. She's the first foreign female worldwide ISA ambassador, and she's here with us in the studio today. Good morning, Shari.
Good morning. Hi, Tai.
Now, why do Okinawans love Hawaii?
You know, there's a... After World War II, Okinawa was completely devastated, and Hawaii Okinawans were in a frenzy to help out. So they sent over food, clothing, regular stuff. But a group of them wanted to do more. They wanted to rebuild the pig industry. And you know how much Okinawans love pork. But in 1948, the Hawaii Okinawan community raised almost $50,000. And today that would be like raising $500,000. And they had this dream of sending over pigs to rebuild the population. So they sent over 550 Chester White pigs from Oklahoma, or Omaha, Nebraska, actually. And, you know, it was actually on a boat, a one-month voyage, that these pigs were sent over from Hawaii to Okinawa.
A month-long voyage on a boat with 550 pigs.
Yeah, they sent over 7 men called the Pig Brigade, and their job was to keep the pigs alive.
That's awesome. They sent over the Pig Brigade.
Yes.
That's why they love us.
Well, you know, they still talk about this life-saving gift of aloha, you know, these pigs from the sea that came over from Hawaii and Okinawa today, and they remember. And it's a wonderful connection between Hawaii and Okinawa.
Well, and Hawaii State is their sister state.
Yeah, we have a sister state relationship between Hawaii and Okinawa.
And it just sort of illustrates that strong feeling of culture and that respect for where you come from. And part of that is the reason why there's a big festival taking place that a lot of folks from Hawaii, 1,000 people, are going to go on the Hawaii Brigade and head on over, hopefully not by boat these days, you know, we've got a plane, to go to Okinawa to be part of this big festival just to share their culture.
Yeah, it's called the Uchinanchu Taikai. So it's this huge party that the Okinawan government hosts every 5 years. And so we're hoping 1,100 Hawaii Okinawans go over. And around the world, the diaspora, so all the children of the immigrants, are going to converge on Okinawa at the same time. So it's going to be October 26th to the 30th. And there should be around over 5,000 Okinawans from around the world coming in.
Now, we've got a little competition going on. We're trying to beat Brazil.
Yes, we have to beat Brazil.
Why is that? Are there that many Okinawans in Brazil?
There are. I think Okinawa has the largest percentage of Japanese outside of Japan. And so there's a friendly rivalry going on between Brazil and Hawaii.
So if they said they'll bring 1,000,
then we
said 1,100.
Yeah.
Our brigade is even bigger. Yeah. Now, there's also an annual festival that takes place here, the Okinawan Festival, and there are some interesting facts about the Okinawan Festival. 15,000 hot dogs are prepared. I'm just thinking of the enormity of that. 75,000 donuts. Tell me a little bit about our local festival, in addition to some of the massive quantities of food that people would find.
So every Labor Day weekend, there is the Okinawan Festival. So this year is going to be the 34th festival. And it's run by 2,000 volunteers. And, you know, over a Saturday and Sunday, 50,000 people come by. And, you know, it was named the best cultural ethnic festival by the Honolulu Star Advertiser. And it's just this wonderful gathering of people. And I was telling you earlier that we have a saying that if you share our values and our heart, you can be Okinawan at heart. And so you're welcomed into the community and can become a part of our community. And the festival is a wonderful way to learn about the culture, but also become a part of our community.
Well, and I'm just doing some math. That means that each person eats more than one donut, a donut and a half. And one in three people have hot dogs. But there's also lots of other things other than the food.
These hot dogs are actually dipped in the donut batter, the andagi batter. So they're called anda dogs.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So
you're
like
dipping
corn
hot dogs in donut batter.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be there. I'll see you there. Now, in addition, there's something else that you've been in charge of, and that is the ISA component of this, the drum festival. And there's a unique project that's going on that's going to be starting soon where people from all over the world are going to get to learn a particular aspect of the drumming and then get together at the festival in Okinawa and drum together.
Yeah, it's actually pronounced ASA.
ASA.
And that's the Okinawan style of drumming, which is very distinct from taiko, which is the Japanese drumming. What we're going to do is we're working with Okinawa, and they're going to be making instructional videos for a traditional and a contemporary song. And from these videos, we can actually practice and learn. So there'll be an easy level for children, elderly, those who are not coordinated.
That would be me. Okay.
And a more complex one. And the idea behind it is that we'll have this video online. People can practice at home, and we'll have some face-to-face sessions. But at the Okinawan Festival in Hawaii, hundreds of us will gather, and we can drum together. Ultimately, you know, what we want is this video is going to go all over the world to wherever there's communities of Okinawans, the diaspora. And when we meet up in Okinawa at Taikai in October, we can have hopefully thousands all drumming together. And this is something that you don't have to be Okinawan to participate in. This will be open to anyone who wants to be a part of it.
And hopefully you don't even have to be very well coordinated.
Yes.
So someone like me could actually be part of this.
Yes.
All right. And you're going to be going along with this contingent.
I am.
You're going to be there. Do we have 1,100 people?
I think we have 1,000. We need a little bit more. So mm-hmm. If you're interested in going, there's the Hawaii United Okinawa Association. And you need to register to them, through them. And if you do that, then you get special passes to all of the big events and the parades and things like that.
And do you have to be Okinawan?
No, you do not have to be Okinawan.
I, too, could uncoordinatedly mess up the drum team in Okinawa.
And, you know, you'd be Okinawan at heart.
I would be until they kick me out. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. Shari Tamashiro is a proud Okinawan American who is the producer of the ASA Drum Festivals and Worldwide ASA Ambassador. She'll be joining her fellow Okinawans in October as thousands head to the 6th annual, I'm not going to say it, Shari, help
Uchinanchu me out. Uchinanchu Taikai.
That one, festival sharing the message of keeping cultural traditions alive for future generations. More information on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. How a happily married couple won a big diamond at a raffle and how that led to nothing but trouble. She wanted to keep it. He wanted to sell it.
I would say we both did at one time say we wish we never would have won.
We did.
It did get to that level.
Diamonds are a marriage counselor's best friend. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, right after With Good Reason.
Kathy, we started out talking about nutritious meals and organic farming, and we ended up talking about hot dogs dipped in donut batter.
And which one do I crave more?
Exactly.
Vegetables. Of course it is, Chris. Of course.
Yeah. We'll have, as we munch our carrots, we'll conclude our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, Dale Kobayashi with the Save Manoa Valley Community Group.
Plus, Sarah Oka, curator of textiles, and the exhibition at Honolulu Museum of Art, No Sweat. And Patrick Wygant, nominated for the Nahoku for his Swanky 2 Jazz album, will be here.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want to past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Kathy Kozak.
I'm Chris Vanderkook. Meet us in the morning for more of the Conversation.